Dr. James Joyner is Associate Professor at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College and non-resident senior fellow at the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council, writing in the National Interest under the title America's Military Needs a New Retirement Plan. The Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission, Dr. Joyner, has looked at this issue. The evidence that we've seen based on the action taken is that there is a confluence of opinion that it is time for changes. What do you see, what do you like in the changes that you're seeing so far that you're writing about in this piece? Thanks for your time today, James.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. Well, look, I think, first of all, I mean, they've spent, almost 5 years studying this with various commissions and back and forth and ran reports and other things that were commissioned in a sort of conjunction with this. And I think everybody's understood. I mean, the current policy, which goes back roughly 70 years now, is that you retire at 20 years, you get 50% of your base pay, and then, as you go forward, if you stay in a little bit longer, it's you get a 2.5% per year, so up to 75% at year 30. And there's been minor changes along the way, but it's basically been that system now for generations. And it made sense back in the day. My father retired under that system back in 1982 as an Army First Sergeant. But that was back in the days when people in the military, frankly, did not make a lot of money. Certainly the enlisted side, but even the officer side, did not make particularly high salaries. And so it was payment in kind. It was a relatively cheap way to keep people interested in staying in for a career. And if they didn't stay in for a career, you owed them nothing in terms of retirement benefits. So that has sort of gone away. At least the proposal is that it goes away. Congress still has to buy off on this. But the idea is that instead of having it vest on this cliff system, 20 years, you get something or you get nothing less than that, is you basically do the same thing we do for other government employees, including myself, which is you're in, a defined contribution plan. You get a little bit of money put in every year. You get matching funds. And then you can start drawing it like, normal people at 59 and a half rather than at 39 for an enlisted guy or, 42 for an officer who did, the 20-year minimum. So that's good. So you create some fairness there. But on the other end, what happens is you go down from, getting this pretty sizable pension at 50%, you go down to 40%, which makes that less attractive. For those who do stay the 20, it's a little bit less attractive. So that is the trade-off. The other main issue to me is that it doesn't address health care. And healthcare is in the military and pretty much in most private sector industries now, that is the big sort of gorilla that it's so expensive and the expectation is it's going to go up, further over time. And it's not addressed at all in this plan.
You write in this piece in the National Interest, Dr. Joyner, one reason the 20-year 50% pension models persisted for so long is that it's a very powerful tool for retaining mid-career personnel who are highly trained and ready to lead. Is it a good thing or a bad thing, or is it just a thing that in conjunction with the retirement modernization issues that the services are considering reforming or changing the up or out policy that may also give those folks who are in mid-career but aren't necessarily likely to rise in rank and so considering moving along an opportunity to stay and become technical experts and become highly recognized for the work that they're doing while not necessarily rising through the ranks?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's been a long-standing debate within the services, and there was a time even in my dad's early career in the 60s when you could be a 40-year-old corporal and you were just going to retire as a corporal but never go in beyond that, but you could be really skilled at what you do, but you just don't have the brain power, the ambition, the whatever to be more than that. Well, the counterargument is that while they may be proficient at their job, in fact, highly proficient at their job, they're basically in the way because the entire personnel structure of the military is geared toward promoting people, moving people through the system, and that you'd basically have people, whether it be a wrench turner, some staffer in the on the enlisted side, or even say somebody who's an outstanding company level commander as an officer, but just doesn't have what it takes to be a staff officer to command at a higher level. But if you leave him commanding a company level unit for 15 years, then he's just basically blocking potentially 7 or 8 other people from getting that experience and being groomed for moving up. So that is really the trade-offs. And I'm not sure that I've got a really strong opinion one way or the other on that. I can see both arguments.
Dr. James Joyner is associate professor at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College, writing in the National Interest about the military's need for a new retirement plan. And you point out something that's part of the math problem here, Dr. Joyner. Since we're quite reasonably grandfathering in those currently in the service, it'll take decades to receive the benefits from these reforms. I know you're not suggesting that we not do them, but that's a point of attention that hasn't really been discussed a lot so far, I think.
No, that's right. And there's no, I think when in 2011, when this stuff was first being trial ballooned or leaked or whatever it was, when it was first the early proposals, including these sort of proposals, were coming out, it was not clear that it was going to be grandfathered. And when I was writing about it, blogging about it, writing about it elsewhere, you simply can't do that. I think there'd been lawsuits, and two, it's been a huge morale hit. So I don't think there was any choice. Now, what they're trying to do, I think that the proposal is that you get people who are earlier in their career, their first 10, 12 years of your career, that you're sort of nudging them toward the new system by saying, hey, we'll give you these matching funds, and then you can get, a continuation bonus, so you get a lot more money up front if you go into the new system now. So I think they're going to try to urge people in that direction.
And that makes sense, because the thrift savings plan option that's included with the people that are going in that new direction winds up being a much better, much more cost-effective direction for the military to go in. Those contributions up front, the matching contributions to the TSP, appear to wind up costing a lot less than the pensions that are paid out on the back end under the old system.
Yes.
It will really be what it boils down to, I think, for both the person who will be making the choice and for the Department of Defense, is it's going to turn into, at some point, a sheer math problem, won't it, Dr. Joyner?
Oh, no, that's exactly right. The RAND study that came out, I guess, 18 months or so ago, they were surveying people, and while they were, for certain people, especially for officers and more senior NCOs, it's a hugely, valuable benefit. Earlier in people's careers, they would just rather have the cash. They would rather be paid more now and not have the other incentive laid down the road, and which is, maybe it's a math problem in the negative sense that they're not very good at the math and but I think most people, especially most young people, tend to prioritize, upfront cash, today rather than the long term. It's a problem. What happened is, so sort of like my dad, he spent, most of his career in making very little money. He was reasonably successful as a senior NCO very early in his career, but starting in right toward the tail end of his career, early in the Reagan administration, we really started raising military pay substantially. But he got out in 82, passed away about 4 years ago now. So he drew retirement pay longer than he was in by a substantial amount, actually, and was being paid more, even on an inflation-adjusted basis, sort of more money than he was paid, the first 18 years of his career as a retiree. And that makes very little sense, right, from an allocation of funds standpoint. It makes sense to invest your money in your current people, and to make sure that the people who served you, long and well, in the past or compensated, and that, you know, that they're taken care of. But you know, that sort of outlay is awfully tough to manage. So yeah, it makes sense to sort of pay as you go, which is what the thrift savings, you know, plan sort of does.
Well, and what's really fascinating about this, Dr. Joyner, is we're seeing not just the military, but we're seeing public sector pension programs set up in such a way that as people live longer, they're spending almost as much money paying people who are no longer working as they are paying people who are still working.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's the situation in which the military finds itself headed toward, at least, if not already in. You point out something else here that I don't think has been emphasized a whole lot, and that is the ultimate goal of all of this discussion is, as you write, how best to retain the best people in an all-volunteer force. And the AVF is a topic that I hear experts bring up time after time after time when they talk about this. What's the implication of that, given that that's kind of the backdrop of all of this?
Well, I mean, there's talk periodically, you know, about trying to, you know, resume a draft or some sort of, you know, required service model, but it's a non-starter. It's simply not going to happen, you know, absent, you know, another World War II scenario. It's just we're not there. And so it's expensive. Now, and the problem with the volunteer force, and it's a fairly obvious problem, it's the same problem any sort of labor market has, is that it depends on what the overall situation is, right? So if, you know, you're in peacetime and the economy is bad, the military is an incredibly attractive option, right? Whereas if you're in wartime and the economy is good, it's a less attractive option. You know, I mean, you know, granted, even after 9/11, you had a nice, you know, sort of people lining up at the recruiting stations, but that wears off pretty quickly, and just the stress and the strain, you know, of deployment, makes it less attractive. And so the way we dealt with it was, I think, not smartly, was to radically increase base pay. You know, the amount of money we were paying people just in salary. And so over the course of the decade after 9/11, we almost doubled base pay. It was a huge increase. And well, the problem is once you no longer need that, so you wind up, one, we wind up having to cut personnel very substantially because, you know, that's where the money is. And it becomes a sort of a compound benefit because, you know, the pension and everything else is based on, you know, that base pay. So it would have made a lot more sense to instead have enlistment bonuses, retention bonuses, increasing hazardous duty pay, which is a pittance. You know, it's like $250 a month, tax-free, but still not much. If you increase that amount, much more expensive maybe up front, but it goes away. You know, once you don't need that surge, that those expenses are gone, and you can manage your personnel in a standard way. But the way we did it, it stuck with us because realistically, you can't say, okay, the war is over, let's cut back base pay back down to an inflation-adjusted 2,000. Well, it's just a non-starter.
Dr. Joyner, a lot of terrific insight in this piece. I congratulate you on it, and thank you for talking about it with me today.
All right, well, thanks for having me.